All right, folks, Bryce Holdaway here and Ben Kingsley. Just wanting to quickly let you know that when we recorded with Chris O'Dell, Ben, it was on an internet connection, wasn't it?
Yep, which wasn't the world's best.
No, but the content was so good because we're talking about the causes, not just the symptoms of housing affordability in
In
Sydney in
Sydney,
particular.
yep.
So just wanting to let you know that because we know the sound quality isn't ace, we've had it transcribed, Ben.
We have.
Someone had to sit there and listen to us and transcribe all that. So, really good content. We still wanted to get it out, but folks, just be aware. You'll still be able to hear it, but in a few parts, there's a little bit of internet sort of
Interruption.
interruption. So, and without any further ado, enjoy the episode with Chris O'Dell.
Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch for each week. Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property, finance, and money management. Hello, Ben.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Very good.
That is good.
August. Are you enjoying August?
I'm enjoying August. I love the guests that we're having on in August.
How terrific. How good was it to play around with those virtual reality glasses?
Oh, it was amazing.
It was terrific. So,
still talking about it.
Yes.
Still talking about
it. If you haven't
it.
Checked that one out, have a look. It's the one we did with Nigel Dalton, which was the chief inventor at REA. If you normally listen to us, Ben, I'd recommend you go and watch us on that one because there was lots of cool stuff.
Yeah, the video is pretty cool.
Hey, we've got a new little feature that we've announced a few weeks ago, Ben. It's a little widget on our homepage to leave a voicemail.
Yep.
Three things I'm encouraging people to leave a voicemail. Anyone who wants just to be cut into a an episode just to say, hey, look, this is how we've benefited from implementing the principles.
Mm-hmm.
We're not fishing for a testimonial. We just want to know the changes that you've made.
Yep.
Where you would have gone down one path, but now you've gone down another path as a result of listening. That'd be great to share with the rest of the community. Number two is any questions you'd like us to answer on the podcast, Ben, leave them, and we will prioritise all of those.
Yep.
So, and it's really simple, Ben. If you're listening to this now on your iPhone, on your Android, on your anything device you've got,
Google Play,
anything, you can just quickly go and leave a message. And if you're listening to it, it will take 90 seconds. So go and do that. We'd love to. And the third request is we're looking for people who want to be interviewed on the podcast, Ben, who are successful property investors who have actually implemented the strategies we talked about. And we'd love to find out a little bit more. So those people who are keen to share that, let us know. Now, we can get some of our clients on, and we will, Ben, but we don't want it to just sound like a flavoured exercise. We want to hear from people who are doing it themselves and want to share it with us. So let us know. And, of course, a couple of other things. REA videos are going very well, therealestate.com.au. Check those out on our social media. Now, Ben, it's time for you to put your Pippa hat on because there's a very important survey coming up.
There is. It's right now, Bryce, we are doing our annual investor sentiment survey. So each year, and we've started this a few years ago, we reach out to all property investors, all budding property investors, and we're going to get a snapshot of how the pulse is out there in the field. What are they feeling? Confident? Not so confident? This year, we've also got a couple of additional questions that we've added in to our regular questions, and they're around the lending changes. Has that restricted you from being able to continue on your portfolio
Ooh, that's
building?
Good intel.
So there's, and what would be the interest rate difference for you to stop or to change from principal and interest to interest only? So we're going to get some great insight, and obviously that then will become available on the Pippa website. So this is our big survey. It's the one we do where we reach out. It's probably the biggest investor sentiment survey in Australia.
Mm.
So we get all of our Pippa members to send it out to their databases. We'll obviously be sending it out to our subscribers as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to learn more, just go to the Facebook page and there'll be information there, or also go to our website and just go into the search on the website for the sentiment survey.
But even easier, Ben, if someone's listening to this on the train, they're just walking as we speak, just click on the photo of you and me on the property couch.
Oh.
The show notes underneath that will appear. They can click on the link that
Stop
Ivis
it.
Will put there. Stiggy will put it there,
this
mate.
This is modern technology.
Simple, mate.
No way. This can happen.
People don't have to go, well, what was that Facebook address again? What was the website again? Just go to the show notes, click on the link and fill it out, because it will take you next to no time, Ben, but it will make an enormous impact for you, the listener, for you, the participator, to get the information that comes out of it, the more people that participate.
Absolutely. So get on board and we'll get an idea of how the market's travelling around Australia.
Thank you with your pipa hat, Ben.
Thank you.
My mindset minute theme today is, before we get on to our very special guest, Ben.
Yes.
Two geese were preparing to start their journey southward for their annual migration when a frog asked if they would be willing to take him with them.
Oh, jump on the back.
The geese said yes, but wondered how it could be done. The frog was very creative, so he produced a long but strong stalk of grass ibis. He persuaded the two geese to hold each end while he clung to the middle with his mouth. The unusual threesome took off and were making good progress when some men below, observing the strange sight, loudly expressed their admiration for their creativity and wondered aloud who had been clever enough to design it. When the frog heard them, his vanity got the better of him and he opened his mouth to shout, "It was I!" He immediately fell to the earth and was dashed to pieces. So,
what's the moral of the
story? What's the moral of the story? If you keep your mouth shut, and people will never know just how ignorant you are. If you open it, you will remove all doubt. So we have two ears and one mouth, and we should use it in that proportion, because wisdom will provide us the answer as to when we should talk and when we should listen.
Oh, very nice. Where'd you get that one from?
Mate, I just sort of pull these things out.
Oh, yeah? Just not revealing your source for that one?
Mate, just...
No quote? No anyone? No.
Well, mate, I as you know, I'm passionate about changing mindsets. So if, I love the power of a story. So I thought, what can I do to create a story? So thank you for your
beautiful
feedback. But today, let's crack into it, Ben. We've got a very special interview with Chris O'Dell, the Manager of Research and Insights in the Department of Planning and Environment. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So we've got a government planner on. I mean, these are the people who set the rules about how we build and what we can do. So it's pretty cool.
How exciting. And and one for the New South Wales listeners too, because us being here in Melbourne, we're correct, very Melbourne-centric. So we've got a nice little New South Wales / Sydney perspective here. But Chris O'Dell loves data and analysis, so much so that he's forged a career using data and analysis to solve real-world problems. Chris is part of the planning and statistics team of the Department of Planning and Environment, and he manages a team that provides analysis to help support our strategic decisions. Prior to this role, Chris studied a science degree and spent 10 years as a consultant in the engineering industry. Chris, that would suggest that you love the detail.
No, I do love the detail. I love getting rolling up the sleeves and just getting myself, you know, immersed in the data and seeing if I can find some fun stories and some stuff that can dispel some myths out there about the topics that I'm interested in. So it's a pretty fun job to be in at the moment, and it's a pretty relevant job too.
Well, I mean, what are some of those myths that that you get to dispel in your job?
The one that really gets me, and it's the one that I sort of bandy about a bit with people, is the classic one is I always hear people talking about how much of an impact the GFC had on housing supply, especially in Sydney.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess we all know that the GFC had a massive impact globally, but in Sydney and in New South Wales and a little bit across the country, the GFC actually didn't have that big an impact on our housing supply. And if you look at the data, it actually tells you that our housing supply numbers were actually dropping about 4 or 5 years before the GFC even hit. So it's quite a convenient story to tell, but it's actually not the truth. We were already plummeting well before the GFC hit. I just think the GFC just might have just, you know, kicked us a little bit further, but it definitely wasn't the cause of a problem in terms of housing supply in this country.
So Chris, obviously, you know, I got to meet you at a recent housing affordability conference that we both did some keynotes at.
Yeah.
And I was really fascinated by the story that you told in your presentation around housing affordability and whether, you know, there is actually an affordability issue or a desirability issue. So I'm really keen to sort of have that conversation around what it looks like, because you brought up a great little slide and you talked about this little town called Never Tire. And, you know, you said many parts of New South Wales are affordable. And I remember it distinctly, $45,000 for a house on 1,362 square metres of dirt just so happens to be a little bit further out from Sydney. How far away is Nevatire from Sydney?
Oh, look, it's about 100 kilometres west of Dubbo. So it's definitely not what you call a metropolis centre of activity in the state. But I guess, like you're saying, it's this housing affordability conversation that everybody's having, it needs to be framed a little bit more about that it's affordable. The affordability is definitely linked to the fact that everybody wants to live in the desirable parts of this country, and the desirable parts of this country happen to be our big cities. And if you go out of our big cities, you actually find places out there that are quite cheap. I think it's 45 grand for a 4-bedroom house isn't a bad proposition for people.
You can get it on your credit card.
You can put it on. I think your bank would just, exactly.
With subdivisibility potential, subject to council approval,
right?
Hey, Chris, if we go to Sydney 101, because we've got a lot of listeners who don't live in Sydney, in fact, don't live in the country, what is it that makes Sydney so desirable?
Well, I'm just sitting in my office right now, and I've got this gorgeous harbour view, and I'm looking out of the window as we're talking, and I can see...
Hang on. Are you in a government department? Shouldn't you be in a brown building in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, yeah. We're lucky. We've got a CBD office, which has got one of the best views of the harbour, that we're very lucky to have it. But,
as town planners, I'd expect that.
we can see people riding in now.
It was good strategic planning.
Yeah, future planning.
So you're looking at that beautiful harbour.
Yeah, so I can see desirability right in front of me. It's a gorgeous place to be. The sun's shining, and Sydney's a good place to be at this time of year. But it's also, as I was talking about, right now in New South Wales especially, we've got the jobs. We've got a really good employment numbers. I think we're at 4.8%, which is the lowest unemployment in any of the states. So, you don't have to be a genius to understand that people come to where the jobs are, and the jobs right now seem to be very much centralised in Sydney and in sort of the surrounds of Sydney, and that definitely leads to desirability, and it definitely leads to the fact that people want to come here. It's a curse that Sydney has, that it's a very popular and a very desirable place at the moment. It is a good problem to have, but it does cause some flow-on effects, and that's what we're sort of seeing right now in Sydney.
And you've got geographical challenges too, in terms of you've got that beautiful harbour to look at, but it provides challenges getting across it. You've got the Blue Mountains and also, the ocean. So not only have you got the largest population trying to get in close to the city, but you've got geographical constraints.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about this a lot, and we know that, you're down in Melbourne, you've got greenfield sites that can pretty much go as far as they want to go in sort of that northwest direction. You can almost get out to Ballarat, can't you, in terms of...
Oh yeah, we've got plenty of land here. I mean, obviously Melbourne's an old flat volcanic sort of wasteland in a way, so it's pretty easy to get there. But obviously with your geographical boundaries and pressures, it's pretty hard to sort of build on that sort of granite that is the Blue Mountains and what have you.
So
it's a bit harder. But I also note that in terms of just to give the listeners an idea. Sydney and New South Wales basically in 2015-16 generated more jobs than any other than all other states combined.
Mm.
Obviously, Victoria did some of the heavy lifting, but there was zero jobs growth in Western Australia, very small jobs growth in South Australia, small jobs growth in Queensland, and so effectively, Sydney and particular New South Wales and even Western Sydney. We've talked about Western Sydney being the fifth biggest economy in Australia. So it just gives you a sense of obviously the demand. And that's, Chris, that's what we're seeing. We're basically seeing this migration story, aren't we? So can you talk us a little bit about this sort of migration and population story that you're seeing?
Yeah, so like you said, we've got the tail end of the mining boom sort of coming off. We've got all these mines that are now operational, which definitely require less people in sort of WA and Queensland. And those tradies, those workers who, were flocking to those parts of the world to chase the mining dollar are now turning back and heading back to New South Wales. So I think New South Wales itself has the lowest net migration out of New South Wales than it ever had. So just to, again, for your listeners to understand, New South Wales has always got a negative net migration, and that's mainly because pretty much everyone that comes into Australia comes in via Sydney.
Yep.
So any overseas migrants coming in or anyone who's sort of coming to settle in Australia usually starts in New South Wales and then heads out to the rest of the country following that. So what we're seeing in New South Wales now is that negative migration almost getting to the point where it's neutral. So we've never been to that point before. So that just means that those migrants who are coming in from overseas are staying put. And we've also got a massive number of interstate migrants who are sort of coming back to New South Wales or looking at Sydney and saying, well, I'm probably going to get myself a job down here. And so that has a really big impact on this state in terms of demand for housing.
Do you see any of that changing at all, Chris, in terms of people thinking, well, I don't sign up for a $1 million mortgage for an average house with an hour and a half commute, where they'd go and take a pay cut in another city where housing is cheaper and, you know, call it Queensland, call it Tasmania, call it, you know, Adelaide. Does your data suggest anything like that might happen now that, you know, you've been through a really big boom cycle in real estate?
Well, I think the construction cycle that we're on at the moment is still continuing. So we've got, about 80,000 homes on the construction in Sydney and New South Wales at the moment, which is more homes than we've ever had under construction in history.
Yeah.
The service industry that drives Sydney is still on the up. And I can't, you know, personally, I just can't see that changing in the short term. But, you know, I'm not an economist, but everyone knows that these things come in cycles. So inevitably it's going to flip and it's going to change and it's going to sort of redistribute employment around the country again as another city or another state has more job opportunities. But in the short term, I can't see that.
Sure. How do we compare to other cities, you know, around the world that are similar to Sydney? Who do you look to get an idea of how you can better plan for the growth in people and the growth in the houses that you've got to build? What are the world cities that you keep an eye on?
Oh, look, again, this is where I get into data. I love data, but I don't know if anyone's aware of this. There's this index out by, I think it's RLB, a consultant who does a crane index for the world, and what they do is they go around and pretty much just count the number of cranes in cities.
Yeah.
And they use those cranes as a bit of a proxy for development activity. And you know, it's unsurprisingly, Sydney's got the most cranes of any other state in the country. But also, if you have a look at what they do for the global cities, there's more cranes in Sydney than there are in all of the North American cities that they count. So Washington, Seattle, I think even Toronto in Canada and a few others. I think about six or seven of them. Sydney's actually got more residential cranes than all of those combined. And it's got, I think it's the second highest number of residential cranes in the world that they monitor. And the highest is Dubai. So we're kind of right up there at the moment in terms of our construction.
So that's obviously you saying you love the data. What other sort of indexes or data do you look at to map Sydney against and New South Wales against the rest of Australia or the rest of the world, Chris?
I mean, our biggest data source is always the ABS. We love the ABS, and we have a lot of time for the ABS.
Is this cash for comment?
And we should never let the ABS go. They're a very important asset to us, to everybody in this country. So we use those guys a lot. But we get a bit creative with our data set. So as I said, we use a crane index to monitor activity. There's a couple of sites out there that do things like a trading index that measure the cost of the hourly rates of tradies across the country, and we monitor that to see, you know, if there's a drop off of the hourly rate of a plumber or the wet trades or the dry trades, and that could be a lead indicator that things are starting to cool down somewhere. And we compare that to what's happening across the country, because there is a lot of debate at the moment about the construction in Sydney that it's being limited not just by the supply, but by limited by the actual, you know, the trades, the wet trades. I mean, how many plasterers do we have in Sydney to actually put on these apartments that we're building at the moment? And that could be one of the factors that sort of limit how many we can build in a year.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, you said when we caught up that between 2016 and 2036, you're anticipating net migration to be around 1.74 million. And so you're talking about needing another 725,000 properties over the next 20 years just to meet demand.
That's right, and that's a lot of houses. It's a lot. I think it works out to be about, I think we've got to get about 36,000 a year to keep up with that. Now,
So, Chris, just on that point, I mean, this is where the planning piece comes in. So this is where you've got to try and get the mix right. And for our listeners, I mean, you know, everyone would love that sort of 600 square metre block of dirt, 500 metres from Bondi or Manly, that land is obviously always under pressure to be reused. So we call it backfill, where, you know, a single dwelling becomes two, or a single dwelling becomes three, or, you know, the rezoning takes shape and then all of a sudden, you know, that street is now zoned medium density and all of a sudden you can get 30 apartments on that particular site. I mean, this is the challenge, isn't it, for planning around, because, I mean, there's always that not in my backyard versus, I love the amenity it delivers me in terms of all of the different restaurants and bars and lifestyle choices. But I also, you know, the scarcity of that single dwelling on that single block, when we get into, you know, numbers like 8 million people living in Sydney by 2051, you know, so how do you go about addressing those challenges?
Look, it's a really challenging one. And like you said earlier, our geographic constraints mean we can only go out so far. So we can go out, but we've also got to learn, and we've also got to accept that we've got to go up.
Yep.
So the land in its scarcity is only going to head one way as this city keeps growing, and that's going to go up, because we're not going to get any more land. So we definitely have to have a good look at ourselves in Sydney and say what type of housing are we gonna build in for new communities. And I think, like you said, the medium density type housing is a great housing choice, because it definitely helps us utilize land in a much better way. But also, it's not that, you know, high density that people are a little bit fearful of. In saying that, though, I don't think there's anything wrong with high density. I think high density is a great alternative for people, or housing choice for people if they want to pursue that. And what we're also noticing in the data, which is an interesting phenomenon in Sydney, is that, you know, in the history of Sydney, and I'm sure this is a very similar history for most of Australia in terms of the families, is that families would, historically, you'd go to uni in town. Find your partner, you check up, you maybe sit in the share house for a while, but then when you decided to have a family, you'd go out to the suburbs, and then you'd get your three-bedroom house and your 600 squares and live a happy family life. And I don't think that's the reality anymore. And what the data's telling us is that people are actually staying put inside the inner parts of Sydney and are having families in two-bedroom apartments, having children in two-bedroom apartments, which is, you know, really changing the way that this city functions and the way that this city is adapting to the kind of housing demands that we need. So it's a really dynamic environment at the moment, because it's changing almost daily in terms of the way people are, you know, changing their housing preferences.
Well, Sydney embraces that more than any other sort of capital in the country, don't they? Because the fact that you guys are building lots of apartments, and it's not becoming an oversupply issue like it is in Brisbane and Melbourne and Adelaide. We've said it before, you know, it used to be Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. It's now Jack and Jill went down the lift to fetch a baby Chino. So people are really changing. They're really changing the way that they see, and I think Sydney leads in that regard. But on that, in terms of your role within the government, do you speak to other people within similar roles in other state governments around the country just to get some of the learnings? Because you'd be facing some unique challenges that the rest of the country would really love to, well, not love in terms of housing affordability, but, you know, there are some oversupply issues in other states. Yeah. Is there a collaboration that you get across the states?
We do a little bit, yeah. Like, we often talk to our colleagues and just say what's going on. But like you said, with that oversupply issue, and this is where Sydney is a bit different, is that you're talking to people interstate. I've noticed with Melbourne and Brisbane especially that oversupply is definitely a CBD-centric oversupply. So very much sort of in the inner parts of the city. I don't know if you guys agree with me on that one.
Totally. Yep.
Yeah, the data suggests that.
Yeah, but we're in Sydney where we've got, and I think it's an advantage that Sydney's got, is that this housing development experience at the moment is very well dispersed across the entire city. So you're getting apartments being built, you know, fairly high density apartments being built, you know, 50 kilometres outside of the CBD, which I think helping the city not have an oversupply in particular areas, but offering those sort of housing choices across the city. Getting back to our colleagues across the border, it's an interesting thing that we talk about where housing and housing choices is a national problem, but it's definitely dealt with more than often than not at the state-centric kind of level. But like we were saying earlier, when Sydney cools off a bit, and I don't know, there's another mining boom or, I don't know, a tech boom in Adelaide or, you know, a tech boom in Darwin or whatever, something happens, the chances are is that Darwin or Adelaide aren't going to be prepared for it because they've been working off the assumption that most people are going to Sydney. And by the time that people decide to, you know, flip and come over to Adelaide or Darwin or something like that, it's probably a bit too late for the planning to keep up with it, which is why we always have a bit of an undersupply problem. So I'd love to see a bit more of a national approach to this where even though, say, Brisbane is a bit cool at the moment, they're still getting ready for the next boom because it will come eventually. It always does.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, obviously, there's no doubt we're moving from a population base of, you know, sort of 24 million up towards that 35 million range. So, you know, you're absolutely right. The shelter will always be an essential need for all population coming through. And there will be certain pockets that will perform better than others purely based on, you know, what you call desirability that we call living and lifestyle drivers that will push people into areas. And, you know, property is a statement of who you are. It's an emotional asset. And so that's why certain areas do better than others. And you know, I know, you know, you said that you live in the sort of Newtown area and you love that sort of vibrant, eclectic type community, arts community in there. I spent 10 years in Sydney and I have a property in Alexandria there and I love that sort of Erskineville village and all of that type of stuff. So these are the sort of things that we're looking for, but we've also got to be accepting of the fact that our two big global cities being led by Sydney are going to have that density increase compared to, say, you know, we haven't seen density until you've seen, say, downtown Shanghai or you've seen downtown Hong Kong or you've seen downtown Singapore, where that density is incredible. You know, if we look at the Australian footprint, our density, you know, per person per square meter is nothing, but there is going to be that generational change that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Bernard Salt calls it the empty island syndrome. We, you know, we've got this empty island with a few sort of coastal fringe activity spots.
I always say to people that Sydney and Melbourne, we want to play with the big boys when it comes to the global cities. We want to get up to that point where we are a global player and a global city and global cities.
Yeah, totally.
But like you said, I mean, density is one of the key factors in any of these big global cities that we all know about. We all go and visit and go, wow, they live very different to us. So I think it's one of those discussions that we need to have as a country and as global cities that, you know, this is what comes with it.
I agree. I mean, anyone who's well-travelled will, you know, people who go to New York, I haven't heard too many people say that they didn't love New York, you know, in terms of having a look around and enjoying New York. I think the same could be said about Sydney and the beautiful harbour there and, you know, same with London. I'm a massive fan of London as a city. Yep. I think it's got a vibe. It's got, you know, real diversity. So, you know, and it's got history. And I think you put all those things together. And for Melbourne, obviously, you know, we're big on our culture and our arts and our sport. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously our education hubs. So, you know, and Sydney being really probably our financial capital. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from those points of view, they are good foundations on which to build, big societies that have really good standard of living and you know, opportunities for people to make a lifestyle that they want to enjoy.
Look, I couldn't agree more. I think, yeah, we really are in a city, and I think Melbourne is the same, and maybe Sydney's just a little bit ahead, where we're flipping from a suburban city to an urban city. I'm pretty excited about that because I love the idea of a real urban city where there's just so many opportunities for people to get out there and do all that fun stuff that big cities bring.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's nothing better than being able to sort of, like, you know, there's two concerts on that night, there's four musicals, there's, you know, two shows, there's four art galleries open. The place is just vibrant, and, you know, there's always that opportunity to enjoy that. But then retreat to, you know, your castle. But that castle could be in the sky, or that castle could be in suburbia.
Of course it can, and as long as it's well connected, that means that you can get around easily, and it doesn't really matter too much that you're living on the 15th floor, because you get out and about, and you're probably not in your house as much anyway, because there's so much fun to do and so many places to go and things to see.
Using that as a bit of a backdrop, Chris, how are you seeing the change in households? Because, you know, mum and dad and the 2.3 kids in the 70s is now, you know, there's an increase in people living alone and people who are choosing not to have children. So how is that coming into planning, and how do you plan for that? Is it just an extrapolation exercise?
Yeah, look, it's a real challenge. Well, it's not so much a challenge, it's just understanding what's going on out there. So you're absolutely right that lone person households are on the increase, but it's driven by people living alone, but it's also driven by the aging population. So what we're seeing in the data and what the data's telling us is that there's a lot more single elderly people living alone, which usually is a woman whose husband or partner has passed away and is living in that family four-bedroom house on her own, and you know, and has decided to stay there and live her life out there in that family house. And we're seeing a massive increase in that we'll be seeing a massive increase in that over the next 20 years, in conjunction with the fact that there's a lot of younger people coming, you know, getting older and wanting to buy their own piece of an apartment or a house or something. So there's a bit of a conflict that we're seeing at the moment in that respect.
I agree, and I want to get into this conversation a little bit deeper, because I think it's really important. See, what people don't realise is there's no incentive for that older lady to get out of that home. She goes and sees her financial planner, and the financial planner says, "Well, your principal home is obviously exempt from any means testing," which effectively means that if we sell your $4 million house or $3 million house and it's unencumbered, you're going to have all this cash. The moment you have all this cash, all of a sudden, you're going to basically, the pension's gone, and now, you know, and now we're going to tax you on the threshold that's above that. So I think governments need to seriously look at that. If we're going to try and allow sort of this flexibility of movement, that there should be some types of exemptions or some types of caps that can potentially encourage those people to move out of that accommodation, which could obviously, you know, accommodate a couple with kids far better than a single old lady who's widowed, or a single old man who's widowed. So that's the type of, you know, that's the type of policy direction we'd like to see from governments, to try and encourage that as a one-off, you know. But there's got to be a cap on it. I mean, if you're selling your $10 million or your $15 million property,
you don't
there
need
should
a
be,
pension.
oh, I think you should, you know, it's probably some tax you'll need to pay in terms of the income that you're going to generate from that money. But that's the story, because they go and see the financial planner, and financial planner says, stay put, you know.
Well, and the other aspect of that, which people don't often think about, is usually that a lot of people are living in sort of well-established suburbs and are elderly, are probably mortgage-free. But like you said, they're asset-rich, but they're cash-poor. So what happens, though, is that the alternative is to go into some kind of a strata setup, and then they're slugged with quarterly strata fees that they're not used to paying. So if you're living in your fully paid-off house and you're alone in a four-bedroom house, then you can make that decision to let the garden grow out a little bit and then get the local, you know, your local neighbour to help you mow the lawn once every 3 or 4 months. Or, you know, you can let that second bathroom pretty much fall apart, because you only use one of the bathrooms and you only use the kitchen and the living, and you let the other two rooms, you know, gather a bit of dust. But you're allowed to make that decision because it's your mortgage. Well, it's your house and you don't have a mortgage on it anymore. Go into a strata and all of a sudden you're flagged with, I don't know, $400 or $500 a quarter. You probably know how much more better than I would, what that is.
Well, it's thousands when you're talking about lifts and
exactly,
you know, all amenities. Yep. So you're absolutely right.
And as a pensioner or as a retiree who's got a very, very defined fixed income with very clear costs, you know, and then you get that letter in the mail that says, oh, there's a bit of a drainage problem and you're going to get hit with a special levy, that really freaks people out, and it should, because they don't have the money or they don't have the income to kind of find that extra $1,000 of damage to the block. So that's another aspect of it that makes it a little bit less desirable for people to sort of downsize out to these parties.
Yeah, that's definitely a consideration. Yeah. I mean, in your keynote, you talked about, you know, ageing and how that's going to affect Sydney. Is there any insights that you can give for people? Are people largely going to stick around the area that they're in? Will they move further out? Are there any areas that are likely to get more of the ageing population than others?
Changes.
I feel like there's that phenomenon where people like to age in place, and they should. So if someone is comfortable in that suburb or their community and they've built the connections, then we shouldn't be telling them that they have to move out because they're occupying a four-bedroom house and there's only one of them. That's not the right thing to do to people. What we should be doing, though, is providing them with an alternative that means they can stay in that community but, you know, downsize to a more appropriate house. And that's one of the challenges that we have as government, and it's something that we are looking at and want to keep working on, because people do like to age in place. There are the tree changes and the sea changes, and that phenomenon is definitely there. And what we also see now is, and this is something that I think is a sort of emerging phenomenon, is you get your cashed-up insider who's sold their three-bedroom house for $2.5 million and then moves up the coast with $2.5 million and then starts buying the coastal properties. And you know what's going to happen then, don't you? It's going to start pushing the value of properties out there because the market will be there for that. So that's something we're keeping an eye on as well.
That's interesting. I mean, because ultimately, when you build these bigger urban cities, you talked about it before about ease of access and getting around. So congestion, those types of things are a big problem. Can you just share with us some of the infrastructure that is being undertaken? Obviously, we've got a lot of listeners all around the world and outside of Sydney. So the people in Sydney know about it. It's called roadworks and delays. But you've got an enormous... You've got an enormous amount of projects underway. You've got tunnels, you've got train lines, you've got light rail. So just, you know, some of the bigger projects that you think are going to make an impact.
So I think the government at the moment is really focused on, I think the infrastructure spend at the moment in Sydney is unprecedented. I don't have the data on it, but it's enormous. At the moment there's the Norwest Metro, which is one of the biggest metro projects, well, the biggest metro project that Sydney's ever seen, and it's connecting the Northwest, which is a huge area for housing growth. A lot of the green floaters out there, I think an enormous amount of houses are going out there over the next 20 years. And up until this project, they were only serviced by a couple of motorways. So there's a metro getting built there, which is going to run trains every 4 minutes straight down to the CBD. And then that's going to connect out to another big, massive metro project, which is sitting in the Bankstown Rail Corridor, where they're going to upgrade a rail corridor, which is, again, a really focused area for the government of urban renewal, where we're going to really upzone and utilise that land and make sure that we can get the right density there. And in conjunction with that, a metro line is going to go in as well, with another four-minute train that's going to run into the CBD. So, you know, there's metros, there's some big road projects going on. There's a lot of sort of mini projects going around all parts of new housing development to try and open up space. So if there's a need for a new water recycling plant, and if that goes in, then that's going to open up a big housing, an area for housing, then the government's really focused on getting all those little mini ones up so that we can get a really cooperative approach to this. So, yeah, huge amount of infrastructure going in at the moment.
And Chris, on that, if you've got more population coming, that will invariably mean more children. So what about school programs? Is there many plans for new schools to be built, or are there just going to be a bit of pressure on the existing ones?
Not working for education, but I do know that there's absolutely a coordinated effort to make sure that schools are responding to the changes in population. So that means, say, for example, I think in Parramatta, which is for people who's not aware of Sydney, it's about 20 minutes outside of Sydney, which is what we're calling the sort of Sydney second city, which is a really...
By helicopter.
Yeah. On the train. I was there yesterday. You get out of the train.
On the train, it's all right.
Not my car.
If you're going to go Parramatta Road,
that's right.
I'd like to get out there. Maybe at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Catch the train, you do it in 20 minutes. I did it yesterday. But, you know, they're experimenting with ideas like high-density schools, so schools that go up, not out. So, you know, more like your Japanese schools where they're in towers as opposed to larger pieces of land. And I know education is looking at those sort of solutions to kind of make sure that there is schools for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's going to have to be part of the mix.
Yeah.
In terms of what it looks like. I mean, the reality is that's what happens when you get these urban cities. They go up. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's the sky is their new it's their new soil. So from that point of view, I completely understand.
Well, we had Nigel on Ben, so if they go up in those towers, they can just put their virtual reality goggles on and see an oval and kick footy to their mates sitting next to them.
Yeah, we had the chief inventor of the REA group on.
It's kind of cool playing basketball on a, you know, the 15th floor, the 20th floor of a tower, looking over the city skyline. I reckon I'd love that if I was a kid.
Well, what, the golf driving ranges are a lot of fun too, up in the sky. Like, yeah. You know, if you've ever been to Japan or into those markets, they've got these golf driving ranges that just randomly appear as you look out over the city. It's like, oh, well, fair enough.
It's nuts. It's those sort of things that look like I don't know. I've been over to these cities and you think, oh, man, this is really cool. And then you realise that actually, you know what, cities aren't that far away from delivering on these things.
Yeah, and it's going to have to be part of the mix. It absolutely is going to have to be part of the mix. So, Chris, I mean, obviously, you know, you're in government, so you've got to probably be careful in terms of what you're talking about here. But if you had the key to the city, what would be one of the things that you would like to see done? You know, if that you think could have a really, really big impact on housing affordability, you know, what would be one of the main things that you think that that the governments need to address or community or business ventures need to address to try and make housing a little bit more affordable?
To me, I think it's really about that diversity of supply. I mean, supply at this stage is probably the key to most of, you know, this housing. You know, once we get the supply back up, and we're doing that, I think, and Sydney's, you know, building more homes than it ever has before. But for me personally, it's that diversity of supply. So it's making sure that when we build a new apartment block or a new high-density precinct, that we make sure that there are affordable housing for people, that we make sure that there's a lot of universal design principles applied to those apartment blocks so that, you know, it's suitable for a family, but it's also suitable for somebody who's got an ability problem. So, you know, if someone's got a wheelchair or a walking frame, they can also live in that apartment. So I'm a big fan of universal design and making sure that our apartments respond to that, and also making sure that we have that nice mix of diversity in our apartments so that it's a two-bedroom, it's three bedrooms, it's one-bedroom studios, it's four-bedroom apartments, it's two levels for people who really want to expand and have that, you know, family life in an apartment block. But also medium density, you know, getting creative with our medium density design and our dual occupancy so that we can utilise the land a bit more. And really just having that conversation about the fact that we are changing in Sydney. And as much as people are a bit scared of it, and I can see why, because it changes the way that you function in city. I live in a terrace house in Newtown, as you said, and right next to my house, they built, you know, seven stories and 220 new apartments, which a lot of the people in my area were absolutely petrified of. And I wasn't too worried about it because, you know, I'm a bit more of a realist when it comes to this and I live in it, so I understood that this was necessary. And the end result of that development was once it's actually finished, people go, oh, it's actually not that bad. It hasn't affected us in any way. And I'm like, yeah, I know, I was telling you that. But it's just the fear of the unknown is also. So it's getting that into making people aware of the fact that it is going to change, but there are a lot of benefits to it as well as there are challenges.
Well, that story just goes to show you can't be a prophet in your own village. But when you're planning these the expansion of Sydney, does the high speed or the potential high speed rail ever come up in discussion? Because we know there's been a few goes at it and it hasn't come off the ground. But surely that's becoming more and more front of mind for people that are trying to plan for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
Look, I mean, okay, I can only comment on that personally. I haven't had a discussion. I mean, we talk about it in terms of what would work for connecting cities together. So absolutely. But whether or not the government is looking at that, something that I probably can't talk about because I don't have a good handle on it. But I'm sure people are talking about it. I can't see why they wouldn't. You know, it seems to me to be something that we definitely need. No doubt about that. And it'd be great to be able to jump on a train and get down to Melbourne in 2 hours. And what I love about high-speed rail is the fact that when you get out of that train, you're in the city. You're not in an airport 45 minutes away. You're right there in the middle of town. So, yeah, I'd love the idea. I think it'd be great with you.
So just on the automation piece and technology and innovation, have you been exposed or is there any penetration into planning and the sort of department around Hyperloop or automated cars and what, potentially, drone transportation and all that type? Is that all being sort of talked about? Because there's obviously projects happening around the world looking at these types of transportation solutions. Mm-hmm. We also saw Elon Musk talk about, obviously, going underground, probably a hidden agenda there to keep the Tesla cars selling. it doesn't want to take the cars off the road just yet. But the reality is, there's going to be obviously tunneling. There's going to be all these options. Is that getting to your level of government in terms of, like, is anyone responsible for looking long-term planning, say, the next 20, 25 years?
Oh, look, it's something that I personally haven't had an involvement in, but I have no doubt. And I think when I talk to colleagues about this, one thing that we do talk about is in the planning space, we have to be a lot more adaptable. So our chief planner for New South Wales is on this and has presented a lot of information about how we have to be more adaptable. I mean, you guys would know this and I know this, being a comfortably middle-aged man, but things are changing quicker than they ever have before, and when something takes hold, it takes hold a lot quicker. I was having a chat actually this morning with my wife, and we were talking about the fact that smartphones have only been around for a decade. But, and that's nuts, because our entire life is now pretty much revolves around the connection and the usage of those devices. And there's no way that type of change is going to slow down. It's going to speed up. So, we absolutely have to get more adaptable and a lot more sort of and we have to respond a lot quicker, because when this technology changes hit, they hit hard and they're going to really impact cities.
They are. And so we don't necessarily want to be planning for high-speed rail if it's going to be redundant in 25 years. We want to probably looking at technology such as Hyperloop and those types of things to potentially move people. If any of the listeners hasn't, so just Google Hyperloop and have a look at some of the videos. It will be a bit scary. We're talking about basically land transportation that moves at as much as 780 miles an hour. So we're talking about 1,200 kilometres. So as quick as aircraft travel along the ground in these chambers. That don't have that resistance. So that's how they're able to move and not have the heat that gets generated through resistance. So it's some fascinating stuff. And obviously, it's of interest to me. And we've had obviously the chief inventor of the REA Group just recently on the podcast. So this type of stuff is real. Yeah, and as property investors and buyers, we need to know, how is it going to change our life? Like, personal assistants in the next 5 years are going to play, these automated personal assistants are going to play an enormous role in our lives to get us organized and organize our data. And that could change the way in which we live in certain cities or in different locations. We could go to tree change and sea change. So that's pretty exciting stuff. And that's why it's pleasing for me that I'm hearing that government are aware of this stuff and that they're also looking at it, at that senior level.
Absolutely. And I also think that I'd like to hope that this sort of tech, we all talk about the city centricity of it, I'd love to hope that this actually makes regions a lot more appealing, because the regions of this state, and I'm sure in Victoria as well and Queensland, they've got so much to offer in terms of lifestyle, in terms of, great housing, great lifestyle, great places to be, great communities. But it's really the jobs that are sort of holding them back a bit. And maybe when we get a little bit more tech savvy, that proximity, that distance becomes less, whether it's because we utilise tech more or because we can travel faster, who knows. But it might open up those regions a bit more to be more desirable places to live, and therefore put less pressure on our cities.
I totally agree, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on record to say I would move out sort of over the Great Divide into the Goulburn-Murray region because it's the weather's spectacular, the choices, yeah, the golf courses, the fishing.
Absolutely.
The lifestyle is amazing. And if I can get back to Melbourne in an hour and yeah, I can actually be productive in that hour, I would do it. You know, I don't necessarily need to live with, neighbours, 15 metres away from me.
No, not at all. I grew up in the Blue Mountains, which is, about 100 k's west of Sydney, up in the World Heritage National Park up there. Pretty idyllic place to live as a kid and grow up. But Sydney was a bit of a magnet for me because it's where the jobs are. If I could tap into Sydney and be physically down here once or twice a month or something and then remotely work, then it might change my lifestyle to it.
So in conclusion, Chris, I guess, Sydney's just had a perfect storm, haven't they, in terms of,
yep,
great economic growth. The job creation has largely been around there, and
yep,
there's a huge desirability. And on the backdrop of historically low interest rates, it, largely as a world city, it was inevitable, wasn't it?
And undersupply for years.
Mm.
I guess that's the one thing that we didn't touch on, but I think it's between the period of 2005 and 2010 when we really turned off the tap, and the housing supply dropped significantly. So even when this boom started and when this housing kind of construction kicked up and the population started to really increase, we actually had an undersupply of about 100,000 homes already. So we actually started quite a long way back. And I feel like we're catching up pretty quickly, but there's still a long way to go.
Well, you're
but yeah, you're right. Sydney's...
Your data suggests that you've got 185,000 new houses in the drawing boards for the next 5 years. So
that's right.
That's obviously on that way to that 725 target, 725,000 you were talking about before.
But what I also say to people in the halls of this planning department and also around the industry is that even though everyone talks about this word of a boom, which is it's a scary word, I think, because inevitably in the boom is a bust. But what I feel like is that this should be the new norm for us. So,
well, that was going to be my next question, because there's no necessarily signs of any of that perfect storm that existed sort of disappearing in a hurry.
I think that there's probably going to be a bit of a stabilisation. So again, ABS is telling us that we're approving about 70,000 houses a year at the moment, 72,000 houses a year, which is it's been consistent at that level for the last 3-4 months. So, but that's well and truly above decade averages of around about 50,000. So we're well and truly above what we need, but I think we need to sustain this. And this is the new norm for Sydney for at least the immediate future. I can't see it slowing down.
Well, that's a good news story that this whole idea of a big bubble that's going to take everyone out, or that people who are sitting back saying, I'm just going to wait for the market to correct in Sydney and it's going to correct by 30 or 40%. The data just does not suggest that.
Well,
all of the underpinning fundamentals aren't suggesting that at all.
You're exactly right. And this is the fundamentals are there. The fundamentals are strong. There's an increase in population by a natural increase, so people having babies and people sort of getting older. And there's also a definite, good jobs in Sydney. I guess, one of the other stats I think I said, which really got me when one of my analysts did this, was if we actually stopped migration in New South Wales, in Sydney, completely stopped it from interstate, from international, and we stopped having babies right now, in the next 20 years, we still need 140,000 new houses to accommodate the people moving through that life cycle of going from a child to wanting a house or aging in place. So, that's a big number.
That's a great stat to...
You heard it here first on the couch,
that's
Ben.
A great stat to finish on, I think. So, Chris, I really appreciate your time. Obviously, it's great meeting you, and, I think we should check in, on an annual basis to see what you guys are up to from a planning point of view and what's happening in your market up there, because it's really important. I mean, at the end of the day, you're the gatekeepers, you're the ones driving the policy, you're driving the planning story for Sydney and all of New South Wales. So it's an absolute pleasure and privilege to have you on the couch and to tell us a little bit about what's happening in New South Wales planning departments and also what are the plans for Sydney.
No, it's been great.
Yeah, I'll second that too, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Ben said to me, came back from this housing affordability conference. He goes, mate, we've got to get Chris on. He's got some great stuff and he's great to chat to. So, again, we appreciate your time. So,
I can talk about this today. People get sick of me talking about it. So I'm glad that I've got a couple of ears.
just a few extra listeners as well. But good on you, Chris.
Not a problem.
As Ben said, we'll check in with you again. And thanks again for coming on the couch.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure, guys. Thanks. That's been fun.
All right, Ben, how good was that? It's not often you get to someone from government to come and contribute, I can see now why you said to get him on.
Well, he's passionate about it, and the best part about that is that he's got a good story to tell. It's a good message. It's a challenging message. Housing affordability is not easily solved, but you get everything into context, don't you? So it absolutely, we keep coming back to this, it is a supply and demand story.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Under supply before the boom started, they're trying to catch up, they haven't caught up yet. So it's still very much a story of, you know, strong demand, tight supply, and that's causing the values to keep moving higher.
And to quote him, Ben, I love finding creative solutions to people's problems using data and analysis. I particularly love predicting the benefits of a project. So he's clearly loves his data, loves what he does, has a nice lifestyle there in the inner west of Sydney. Life's good as Chris. So thanks again, Chris, for coming on.
Chris.
Hey, my life hack's very, very quick, Ben.
Yes.
In our household, we probably go through a minimum of 50 eggs a week. Did you know that?
50?
Yeah, minimum.
What are you growing them and hatching them and then eating the chicken breasts?
Do you know that the yolk of the chicken is the most healing part of the egg? So quite often we will get, we got a Thermomix, so we get six, here's a little life hack.
Oh, there's a plug.
We get six egg yolks, not with the white, put them into the thermo, 2 tablespoons of honey, put it on 6 minutes at 60 degrees, speed 4, and it makes the most amazing custard, which the boys can eat, and they gag for it. So we go through a lot of eggs.
What do you do with the whites?
Well, they just... we freeze them for pavlovas, mate. No, I'd love to say
you've got a greeny bin.
I was just saying that we wipe it on our face. No, we don't. In fact, we probably haven't found a very good use for the whites.
Well,
because we don't eat pavlovas.
Well, maybe they can help with your push-ups.
Yep.
So you can, you know, dig for the beach.
Yep.
So you can...
Mate, I am still doing those 10, don't worry about that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad
you are. So here's a little one for you, because we're eating a lot of eggs. We scramble them, we poach them, we have them in Russian custard, all this sort of stuff. Steaming eggs, Ben. Steaming them. So put the steamer on the hot plates. We put the eggs in, sometimes 6 or 7 or 8.
Yep.
Whack them in for 9 minutes. For
not boiling, just steaming.
Not boiling. Here's the magic. Here's the life hack.
Right.
Because when you boil them, what do? You have to, you know, individually take every little mosaic of the egg off. It takes you forever.
Yep.
If you steam them, Ivis, I've got your attention. I like that. When you steam them, you put them in for 9 minutes, up 9 or 12, depending on how hard you want the egg.
Yep.
And then once they're done, put them straight into a bowl of cold water.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then crack them, and the egg just peels off. Like the shell just peels off in two sections. So for those people who love boiled eggs, try steaming them.
Ooh.
And they are more fluffy. There you go.
More fluffy.
There you go.
Why are we doing a cooking show? Well, I mean, this is great.
So that just goes to prove that I eat eggs and grass. So, but there you go. Try it, guys. Steam your eggs rather than hard boil them. Did you know?
Did you know, Bryce? A couple of did you knows. I'll start off with, I'm in my eye. I do need glasses. I absolutely need glasses.
Well, at your age, you should, mate.
So I'll start with the first one. You can, true. Well, you know, 47 now, birthday boy.
Not like a young un like me.
As of yesterday.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for acknowledging that for me. So there you go. Don't worry about that. We'll move on. Okay.
What?
It's not about me. It's not about me. Ivis is now giving me a little cuddle saying, happy birthday. Well, it's not about me. Let's move on.
It's not about him, but he said that three times.
You cannot snore. You cannot snore and dream at the same time. You cannot snore and dream at the same time.
Well, you don't do a lot of dreaming then.
So, no, I don't. Because I do plenty of snoring. Now, into the more interesting stuff.
Hang on, can I just put a quick put in there?
Yeah.
So when we do our conferences, you've obviously got to share the accommodation with poor Jamie from up in Sydney.
Yes.
And then we're about to go to America, the three of us. And I've got to share with you, so...
Earplugs.
I've got to get heavy-duty earplugs, don't I?
Yeah, I can sleep in the bathroom. All right. Now, a couple on lightning.
Mm.
Did you know that men are 6 times more likely to be struck by lightning than women. And I tell you, sometimes Jane would wish I'd get struck by a lightning. So I wanted, you know, she would like to see my numbers grow in that space. So there you go. So six times more likely. And here's one that just completely blew me, and I don't even know the science behind this, but apparently bolts of lightning can shoot out of an erupting volcano.
Fair dinkum.
How the hell, how does that work?
I don't know.
I'd
like to see that.
I would like
only
to.
On YouTube.
So,
right?
So talking about our little icon on the website, if you know how lightning will actually shoot out of a volcano, can you leave us a voicemail? Because I want any of you, a scientist out there, and you know that, then leave us a little voice message and we'll play it on the podcast to sort of say,
it's a good point.
We know the answer.
It's a very good point that you make, Ben.
I have no idea how that would work.
We can use that voicemail for people to leave me life hacks, and also, so very. Oh mate, you are really growing in that Did You Know segment. Seriously, that's really stretching minds.
I'm embracing it, Bryce.
I know.
I'm embracing.
I'm loving it. I'm loving it. So there you go, folks. Again, we've had some terrific insights into the New South Wales, and more specifically the Sydney market today, which has been terrific, and lots covered off that. And mate, we've still got some terrific guests to come, including at the end of the month. An international sports star who we will not be telling who it is yet.
It's a surprise.
It's huge.
Yep, huge.
Huge. So stick around for that. So stick around, all guests.
All guests, there we go. It's hashtag.
Hashtag all guests, thanks to the stick. So mate, until next week.
Until next week, Bryce. You almost have it. See, I was ready. Knowledge is empowering, but only if you act on it.
Mate, you've got wisdom beyond years. And of course, until next week, mate.
See you later.
See you later.